Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the former president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki's visit to Washington to lobby Congress, the IMF, and the World Bank to stop the illicit flow of money out of Africa through crime, corruption, and tax evasion. Eric Lecompte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, environmental, and human rights organizations, joins us to discuss how the developing world loses approximately $1 trillion annually through illicit financial flows that a recent 60 Minutes investigation revealed are often aided and abetted by Wall Street lawyers only too willing to set up shell companies to hide ill-gotten gains from dictators, politicians, drug traffickers, human traffickers, and terrorists. Then we'll speak with Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, and the forthcoming book, Listen, Liberal. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, The Issue is Not Hillary Clinton's Wall Street Links, but Democrats' Core Dogmas, and how the Clinton-Sanders race highlights the Democrats' identity problem as the party drifts away from serving the interests of America's workers to representing the so-called technocratic innovators. Then finally, we will go to Nevada to speak with Eric Herzig, a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, the American presidency, and the politics of Nevada. With Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders now neck and neck in the latest polls ahead of next Saturday's Nevada caucus, we will discuss the sudden gains Sanders has made and Trump's likely victory on the Republican side, even though next Tuesday's GOP caucus is limited to registered Republicans only. And joining us now is Eric Lecompte, who's the director of Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so that the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relationship to the international debt crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Lecompte.
Ian, it's great to be with you.
And former South African President Thabo Mbeki is visiting the United States, and he's in Washington now, and apparently he's focusing on how the developing world loses money to corruption. The figures, though, are pretty extraordinary. I mean, Mbeki's focus is largely on the flow of illicit money out of Africa through crime, corruption, and tax evasion. But the extraordinary statistic is that the developing world loses approximately $1 trillion annually through these illicit financial flows. That's a breathtaking figure.
It's absolutely staggering, Ian, and especially it's staggering when you understand, as we all understand, that the developing world has so many problems. Not enough money for basic food security, dealing with climate change, but throughout sub-Saharan Africa, we're looking at some of the highest and most extreme poverty rates in the entire world. So when we acknowledge that the developing world every year is losing money to crime, tax evasion, and corruption to the tune of over $1 trillion annually, that literally means that there's not enough money in the coffers to meet the very basic needs and demands of the people. And so President Mbeki is here in the United States right now in order to raise awareness about how terrible this problem is in the developing world. It certainly affects the United States and the developed world as well, but the level that it's impacting the poor world, the developing world, is absolutely horrendous.
And former South African President Thabo Mbeki is meeting with the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and U.S. government officials. But I take it a lot of the Congress people that he's meeting with have essentially been alerted by that recent 60 Minutes investigation where they did a sting investigation where they had a German actor posing as an agent of a minister of mines from an African country that was not named, where he wanted to have a lot of money laundered. And the amazing thing about this recent 60 Minutes investigative journalism piece was that almost every one of these big New York law firms bent over backwards to accommodate this phony agent of the African mineral minister who wanted to have his ill-gotten gains laundered, with the exception of only one person who cited that it's against the law and didn't want to touch it. So as much as we talk about corruption in the third world, there's also corruption right here on Wall Street.
But, well, that's exactly right. The reality is with the exception of Kenya, the United States is the easiest country in the world to set up these anonymous shell corporations, these vehicles that allow money laundering. And not only, you know, as we're certainly concerned about in our work at Jubilee, you know, this money laundering is a theft from the poorest people in the world, but these same anonymous shell corporations are also the vehicles that facilitate Medicare fraud, facilitate terrorism, facilitate human trafficking. They facilitate all kinds of crime. But certainly our concern is how it impacts the developing world. You know, and President Mbeki, the reason that he's focused on this is he was appointed by the entire African Union to head a very high-level panel and investigative committee on these issues last year. And in his report, he certainly acknowledged the problem of these anonymous shell corporations that were lifted up by 60 Minutes. And now both Republicans and Democrats are introducing legislation to try and curb the use of these kinds of corporations. But the kinds of things that President Mbeki is talking about are not only limited to these anonymous shell corporations. Right now, about 80% of that $1 trillion that's lost takes place through a process called trade misinvoicing, where various capital and resources and different kinds of materials are leaving the developing world, but they're not being taxed properly at the ports, at the customs areas as they go out. So we know that there are lots of ways to be able to curb this amount of money, keep it within the economies that need it. Because right now, for every $10 in aid that the developing world is receiving, they're losing more than $100 because of these quote-unquote illicit financial flows, money that's leaving because of crime, corruption, and tax evasion.
Now, Eric, there has to be a reason why the U.S. and Wall Street is accommodating both terrorism and kleptocratic third world regimes in laundering money. My understanding is that the reason it's hard to reform all of this shadow banking and these shell companies in the Cayman Islands, etc., is because America's wealthiest corporations hide their money there, as well as America's wealthiest families and billionaires.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, these kinds of shell corporations help to facilitate all kinds of tax evasion in hiding money. And, you know, we often talk about these kinds of things being in the, you know, in the Caribbean, in the Cayman Islands. But the reality is that these shell corporations are being set up in the United States. Right now, Delaware is one of the easiest states in the United States to actually set up your own shell corporation. So, you know, shell corporations are certainly connected to tax havens. They're connected to, you know, being able to move money around illicitly. And it's an incredible concern, and that's why the various pieces of bipartisan legislation that are now in front of Congress are so important.
Well, the 60 Minutes piece made it pretty clear how it's done, because these lawyers were telling this German actor who was representing himself as the bag man for an African country's minister of mines and minerals or whatever, who had a lot of money that he wanted to park, and it was pretty clear that it was illicit and ill-gotten gains, but they provided a roadmap with all the shell companies. It was almost like they could press a button and they already had the paperwork ready.
Well, that's the reality, and it's very unfortunate. I think it's simplistic, but it's also realistic to say that for many of these firms, money is the bottom line, and money drives whatever they're willing to do. Now, with that said, even though some of the behavior is illegal. Not all of the behavior is illegal. It's certainly unethical from our point of view, but that's also why Congress needs to do more to increase reporting, to make it much more clear of the illegality and the lines that are crossed by these firms. But, you know, in terms of the 60 Minutes interview, you know, straight off the bat, you know, many of those that were interviewed were confronted with what were clearly illegal prospects. But because money was the bottom line, they said yes and asked very few questions.
But there was one lawyer who cited the Corrupt Foreign Practices Act and that it was clear to him that this was a clear violation of the Corrupt Foreign Practices Act. Is that the act before Congress that is you're trying to bolster?
Well, certainly, you know, we do believe the Corrupt Foreign Practices Act does need to be strengthened. But we also believe that it, related to anonymous shell corporations, tax havens, and the whole area of shadow finance, there are several pieces of legislation which are actually quite important. You know, some of the transparency legislation that was just introduced by Republicans and Democrats in Congress, the new Transparency Act, that seeks to make it more difficult to set up an anonymous shell corporation or when an anonymous shell corporation is set up to very specifically increase the reporting requirements to the U.S. federal government and to law enforcement. We think those kinds of initiatives are a step in the right direction. Also, initiatives like the Stop Take Tax, Tax Haven Abuse Act, another good step in the right direction. But, you know, as good as they are, neither of these things actually go far enough to do everything that needs to be done to stop this kind of corrupt behavior.
And Eric Lecompte, you've been working with the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. What is the UN trying to do in regard to stopping this extraordinary flow of illicit, ill-gotten money from the third world, which is, reaches $1 trillion per year?
Well, one of the most important things happened this past July, and that was part of a multi-year process we'd been a part of and we're still a part of, and that was a very special global United Nations development gathering. It only happens 7 or 8 years. It's called the Financing for Development Gathering, and that that global meeting took place in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, this past July with world leaders. And working with the former Secretary Kofi Annan, working with other high-level people and certainly citing the very important information and research that President Mbeki had done, which had been released prior to the Financing for Development Conference, we were able to win several global agreements that work towards higher reporting, curbing this behavior, and also trying to implement very clear global solutions. Now, even though there was broad-based agreement in the Financing for Development outcome, even though there were some general guidelines to solutions, right now we're kind of getting into the details. And over the next year to 2 years, it's going to be the follow-up from that process. And what we're trying to do is implement various global laws and regulations that prevent the behavior. I think the real challenge with anonymous shell corporations, things like tax havens, all these areas of the dark world of shadow finance, the problem is we might be able to stop it at some point happening in Delaware or stop it in Kenya or stop it in the Cayman Islands. But once you stop at one place, it moves somewhere else. It's kind of like whack-a-mole. And that's why it's so absolutely critical that we do have a solution that impacts every country in the world so that it's not just about hitting one mole or another mole pops up. And so that's why the UN processes are important. But we also know that whenever we're able to move forward in the U.S. Congress sets an example that's generally followed the entire world over.
Well, when you were mentioning earlier, Eric Lecompte, about the price that the continent of Africa pays, and that is why former South African President Thabo Mbeki is here in the United States to try and strengthen these laws to stop this flow of illicit money out of Africa through crime, corruption, and tax evasion. And as we've mentioned, the extraordinary figure of $1 trillion annually is lost to the third world through these illicit financial flows. It's no secret, of course, that Thabo Mbeki's successor, Jacob Zuma, is in trouble in both the political world and in terms of press investigations in South Africa into his illicit financial dealings. And it's pretty embarrassing. He had a recent sort of address to the nation in what would be the South African equivalent of the State of the Union address. And he was roundly booed and heckled and called all kinds of names as a crook, etc. So it's obviously affecting the highest levels of South African governance, this corruption. But there was also a piece that I actually saw last night on Network News of a family in, as you know, as you mentioned earlier, sub-Saharan Africa is being hit by an extraordinary drought as a result of El Nino. And there's tremendous hardship in South Africa, Lesotho, and all these other countries. And they showed a family, kids that literally have to go to school without breakfast. And the only meal that they get a day is this kind of watery porridge at school. And they showed all these fallow fields that are dried up because there's no water. And it's only going to get worse. So when you think about the suffering of the people in Africa compared to these fat cats stealing money blind and hiding it in the West, it's truly disgraceful.
It absolutely is. And I think we need to understand that these kinds of issues and why we focus on them as development issues is these are the structural causes of poverty. When we have leaders stealing money like this and then laundering it through various tools, it's really, from our perspective, a crime that impacts the very poorest people of the world. And I think too often these kinds of corrupt practices, the victims are the ones that we don't recognize. And so that's why we really understand that solving this is ultimately about solving the structural causes of poverty, solving the structural issues of inequality. You know, the flip side of this issue, and also a very big part of why we look at it, are issues around responsible lending and borrowing. You know, we have to understand that countries all over the world don't necessarily have the level of public budget transparency that we enjoy here in the United States. I know we often see the budget debates that take place in our Congress, and they seem very strange to us when Congress can't come together. But on the other side of that, that's a very positive thing, that our budget is debated, that almost 98% of our entire budget can be audited through the General Accounting Office and through our member of Congress. In much of the world, that doesn't happen. And so when there aren't clear regulations around budget transparency, around responsible lending and borrowing, when various countries, leaders around the world take out debt that they say they're using to finance infrastructure like building schools, that money at times is laundered out of these countries through the use of things like anonymous shell corporations so that the money can stay in the pockets of these incredibly wealthy people that are literally stealing this money directly from the poorest people in their country.
Well, just in closing, Eric Lecompte, do you think former South African President Thabo Mbeki will be successful in getting the Congress to act and to try and close these loopholes, given that the same loopholes that need to be closed are the ones that the wealthy corporations and individuals here in the United States use as well?
Well, I think that there's certainly a very powerful lobby that wants to keep them open. But I think one of the promising things we're seeing about the legislation is how much bipartisan support it's enjoying. I think when we look at these kinds of tools, like anonymous shell corporations, it's important to acknowledge that, you know, that they're more than just tools for the ultra-wealthy to move money. They're also the very mechanisms that facilitate terrorism, that facilitate human trafficking, and facilitate other types of corruption. So, you know, I think President Mbeki's visit is coming at a very timely moment. You know, are we going to see things change overnight? We're not. But I'll tell you, you know, since we first started doing this work just about 5 years ago, no one was talking about it. But now these kinds of issues are not only in front of Congress, but these kinds of issues of shadow finance are much more in front of all of us as citizens of the United States.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Eric Lacombe.
Thank you. Take care, Ian.
You too, Eric. And again, I've been speaking with Eric Lacombe, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations, and they have won critical financial reforms of more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the best-selling author Thomas Frank about his new article at The Guardian, "The Issue Is Not Hillary Clinton's Wall Street Links, But Democrats' Core Dogmas." Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and most recently, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He has a forthcoming book, Listen Liberal, and an article at The Guardian, "The Issue Is Not Hillary Clinton's Wall Street Links, But Democrats' Core Dogmas." Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
It's great to be here.
And there's an old joke, of course, that the establishment or the oligarchy, whatever you want to call it, owns the Republicans outright and rents the Democrats. And
That's good.
And as such, in a curious way, the Republicans have more authenticity in as much as they do the wealthy's bidding. They're the whores and hirelings of the rich and powerful, and they do their bidding. Whereas the Democrats have a bit of a problem. They get their money from the same people the Republicans get their money from, but they get their votes from working class people who are being shafted.
Right. That's right. Although these days both parties get a lot of votes from working class people, and weirdly, they both get a lot of votes from very wealthy people as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so look, I've just spent the last year writing a new book about the Democrats and why they've been so disappointing over the years. And there's all sorts of different theories about why that is. You mentioned a kind of a comical one, you know, that they're rented. But there's another one that I like from the 19th century where it's like the lifeboat theory. Okay, so the Republican Party, you know, hits an iceberg and sinks, and they all the oligarchy all climbs into the lifeboat known as the Democratic Party, you know, until they can get their Titanic built again and start steaming around. But I focused on the last 30 or 40 years, and there's a pretty profound change in the Democratic Party in that period where they deliberately went from being a party that cared about the working class to being a party that cared about a different social class. And they did this deliberately, and they talked about it quite openly. This is in the 70s and the 80s and up into the 1990s. And my opinion is that this the war that's going on among Democrats right now, you know, represented by Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders, that this is really a kind of referendum on that big change that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Well, at this moment, though, it does appear to be a little quirky and somewhat unexpected, if not unconventional, what's happening in our political year. And
Oh, my God, yeah, it's out of control.
It's out of control.
The craziest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
And you know what? It's, as someone who follows politics, it's a hoot. It's a blast.
Right.
But as someone who's going to have to live with the results, you know, it's something different.
Well, in terms of Hillary and Bernie, though, it would seem that both of them stress that this is kind of a middle-class revolution that they're addressing. And in a way, that's a kind of de facto recognition that the Democrats have lost the working class. And curiously enough, Donald Trump is bringing them in, out of the woodwork, and into these rallies in droves.
I know. It's extraordinary. It's mind-boggling. And he's saying things like, what? I read this in the paper the other day, so it's got to be true. That he thought George W. Bush should have been impeached for the Iraq War. I mean, is that – and he wants to be the Republican nominee for president. It's
right.
I mean, what's happening now is just – it's mind-boggling. And that, you know, and that Bernie Sanders is able to – has been able to, you know, to defeat – well, he defeated Hillary very soundly in New Hampshire with 80% of the youth vote. Now, this is a man who – you know, I like Bernie Sanders a lot. I interviewed him for Salon.com about a year and a half ago, and you know, he sort of prefigured a lot of the things he's saying today. But this is a man who all my life people have thought of as a kind of an eccentric guy from one of the sort of remote corners of American life, you know, not a mainstream political figure at all. And look what he's doing. It's mind-blowing.
But what Donald Trump is doing, along with being the only honest voice that's appraising the Iraq War disaster and taking on that outrageous canard by the Bush brothers that somehow George W. Bush kept us safe in spite of 9/11 and all the warnings that he ignored, Trump in many ways is showing more courage than the Democrats have, because they've never really taken on Bush over the Iraq War and over the reckless endangerment of the United States prior to 9/11. But the other thing that he really harps on a lot, which has to be resonating with the working Americans that are flocking to his banner, and that is these trade deals. And he keeps
going after
them. And isn't that at the heart of your argument?
Yes, Bernie is doing that as well. But you know, truth be told, ever since NAFTA passed, Democrats have been promising to reverse it. You might recall Barack Obama, the man currently in the Oval Office, got there by promising to repudiate NAFTA and renegotiate NAFTA. I mean, that was one of the many things that he promised on the campaign trail. Of course, he changed direction on that almost instantly, and you know, did a complete about face and negotiated the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, it sort of extends the NAFTA model, you know, across the Pacific. But this is a constant theme with Democrats. Now, the thing about Bernie Sanders is there's good reason to think that he means it, you know, because he's always been, that's where he's always been. Whereas Hillary, you know, just seems like an opportunist. She'll say anything. I mean, it was her husband that fought so hard to get that passed. It's hard to remember what NAFTA meant at the time. I mean, we know about how it, what it's done to jobs and how it's made it so easy for companies to move overseas and all that. But at the time, it was regarded as an act of presidential courage. All the mainstream pundits, you know, looked at what Bill Clinton was doing. Not only did they agree with it, you know, there's a famous, you know, they talked about it as a no-brainer. This was very common at the time. This was something you didn't even have to think about. Everybody knew how good NAFTA would be. But it was an act of courage because he was defying his own, you know, his own supporters and organized labor. Not only defying them, but injuring them, you know, wrecking their chances, you know, making it harder for them to organize people and to get better wages, you know, basically ruining the American working class. And this was regarded as an act of supreme leadership. You know, whereas you and I might look at it and say, that's stabbing your ally in the back. Well, I mean, what kind of move is that? But that was thought at the time to be an act of great genius. And that's all part of the sort of the consensus about who the Democrats were and where they needed to go that I think is finally coming apart this year. And thank God.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter of Kansas. and most recently Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and Unlikely Comeback of the Right. His forthcoming book is Listen, Liberal, and he has an article at The Guardian. The issue is not Hillary Clinton's Wall Street links, but Democrats' core dogmas. So, Thomas, as the Democrats struggle with their identity and trying to articulate what they stand for with their constituency that is really deserting them. You have to look at the record very recently, in spite of the fact that the Democrats are the natural majority party, because there are a lot more working and middle-class people than there are wealthy people in this country. But yet the Republicans control two-thirds of the state houses, the governorships and legislatures. They control the House and they control the Senate. So yep. It's amazing how well they've done. But the one thing I think that both – that it's all about, and this is one thing that Bernie Sanders keeps talking about, it's all about money. And is that what the Democratic dilemma is, that the Clintons and others decided to move the party towards Wall Street to get Wall Street's money because the union money was drying up, because unions are now down to about 7% of the workforce?
Well, I think that's, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But I think that it's I think that the money was an added benefit. I think it's I would sort of flip the causality. Okay, I would say that the Democrats decided to move towards Wall Street. There's no doubt about that. This is a documented, easily documented fact. You know, from dating back to the Clinton years and even before, that's what they chose to do as a party. Whether they chose to do it for the money or out of an ideological for ideological reasons is what I'm examining in this book of mine that's coming out in about a month. And what I decided is that they did it for the ideological reasons. And the money has, you know, it's now just obscene, the kind of money that Wall Street throws around. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't always that way. They were just one industry among many 20, 30, 40 years ago. What happened is, and you see this with the Democrats going back to the early 1970s, that they decided being the party of labor and of working people really wasn't what they wanted to be. They wanted to be the party of, you know, the post-industrial new economy, although that phrase didn't come in until the 1990s, but they were already talking about, you know, being the representative of postmodern, post-industrial industries, clean industries, certain desirable industries. This was already they were already talking about this. This was a well-established sort of trend in the Democratic Party in the early 1970s. By the time, you know, and Bill Clinton was sort of there were many sort of institutional representations of this. One of them was the listeners might know about the Democratic Leadership Council, and Bill Clinton was the chairman of that one year. And then, became president, and sort of made this turn in the Democratic Party into a, you know, he put it in concrete. He set it in concrete. He made it permanent, and it's never been reversed since then. You know, this is, you look at the sort of the speeches of Barack Obama. He says exactly the same things. Now, he has succeeded in making Wall Street angry at him, you know, by regulating them. But he certainly started off as he looked like he was going to be another, you know, fantastic pro Wall Street Democrat. He had all the markings of that at the beginning.
Well, but there does seem to be a difference, though, in terms of who the parties get their money from.
Yes,
and with the influence of the Koch brothers on the Republican side, it's pretty clear that the Republicans are doing the bidding of the fossil fuel industries and the old extractive industries, if you will, and that the Democrats have sort of segued, if you will, to the Silicon Valley types.
You're in
Los Angeles, so
okay,
not
so
too
sorry.
Far.
I get California mixed up.
It's okay.
Isn't that where Silicon Valley is?
No, it's in Northern California.
But sorry.
Californians are mixed up.
But there's this other industry out there. I'm trying to remember. Oh, yes, the movies.
Yeah, the movies. There you go. Of course, they jokingly refer to Los Angeles as the Democratic Party's ATM. But I think just to give Silicon Valley a bit of a break, by the way, a lot of their billionaires are libertarians, frankly.
Yes, that's right. They are. That's one of the interesting things about it.
But to give them a bit of a break, at least, you know, Google and Apple and these companies make products that people actually use, like, and enjoy, as opposed to those that are polluting the air and killing the planet. But
okay, fair enough, Ian. But people said exactly the same thing about Wall Street 10 years ago. You know, look, they were making homes, you know, new homes accessible to everyone with these fantastic new financial innovations. And the word innovation, Democrats love this word, you know, innovation this, innovation that. We've got to support innovators. And 10 years ago, that's who they applied it to, was Wall Street with their, you know, amazing financial innovations. They were, look at what they were doing with all of these things, slicing and dicing and getting out there and eliminating risk. You know, it was supposed to be so wonderful, and it didn't pollute. Wall Street doesn't pollute, or at least if they do, you know, they pollute somewhere else. You know, you don't actually see it. It's not, but yes, you're absolutely right. But I don't know. I mean, we the thing about Silicon Valley is we're only just starting to see what the downside of this industry is. We're only starting to understand what it has made possible, all of this interconnectedness, what kind of spying it's made possible, what kind of monopoly power it's made possible, what kind of things these people are able to do to labor. You know, it's not as wonderful as it seems.
Well, just to focus on the telecom reform, in quotes, under Bill Clinton, look what that has wrought. There is nothing more obscene in this country than the fact that the United States is where the Internet was invented, and not necessarily by Al Gore, but it was clearly invented here in the United States.
Yeah. And the Defense Department, I believe.
Yeah, but we have the worst Internet on the planet. The average speed in the U.S. For broadband is 9 megabytes per second. And now you have Time Warner, one of the oligopolies that are just fat and lazy and disgusting, and they give you the worst service, and they keep charging you more money. They're boasting now that you can get 50 megabytes per second. For God's sake, in South Korea and Japan and even in France, it's a gigabyte, 1,000.
Yeah.
And in places like Chattanooga, where the utilities have managed to break three of the oligopolies, they give you 1,000 megabytes.
And so that's about that.
Oh, yeah, but there's a direct – that is anti-capitalist. It's a direct result of crony capitalism. It's the worst example of how the American people are getting shafted with lousy service and increasing costs.
Okay. So you've touched on a really, really important point, which is monopoly. And, there used to be laws against monopoly in this country, and surprise, the laws are still there. One of the fascinating things about the Obama administration, fascinating or frustrating, depending on how you look at it, is their almost complete refusal to enforce the antitrust laws of this country, you know, to just let that stuff go. And this is now typical within the Democratic Party. Obama has been the worst. He's basically just decided to not enforce it at all. You know, you look at the big banks now. You know, we're in this kind of obscene situation where there's just a handful of banks completely dominating the industry. But you can trace it back, of course, to the Clinton years. Clinton deregulated. He did enormous favors for the telecom industry and for the banking industry. And if you go back and look at how these things were described at the time, it was always, you know, these changes are inevitable. You know, this is the 20th century. This old Glass-Steagall law and the various other banking laws that Bill Clinton got rid of, these are the Depression-era laws. We've outgrown them. We're so much more advanced than that now. And guess what? Doesn't work that way. Capitalism will always generate monopolies unless you aggressively regulate against them and aggressively enforce the law against them. And we don't bother anymore. There's monopolies everywhere. I mean, you know this story,
right? But Thomas, just to bring it up to date in terms of what we're talking about with the current race, with Donald Trump saying, "I'll make good deals; these politicians make lousy deals." Did Clinton and company make lousy deals because they were naive and that the telecom executives were outsmarted them, or were they in complicity with?
They did it out of faith. They did out of idealism. I mean, this is I'm not a big fan of Bill Clinton. And I don't really understand what made him go and why he did what he did the things that he did. But there was there's a kind of capitalist idealism among Democrats that's different from the capitalist idealism of Republicans. You know, Republicans with their almost religious faith in markets. Democrats have a faith in a certain class of people, a certain kind of capitalist. Knowledge workers, the creative class, you know, they use these terms all the time. These are the people that they fall down on their knees before, right? And they regard them with the sort of the noblest kind of light. And they can't understand how things would go wrong with these people in charge. I mean, in my view, it comes back to class. The Democrats are the reason we keep, you know, being so surprised and astonished when the Democrats fail to, you know, do the obvious things that need to be done. You know, even when you've got a guy like Barack Obama who comes sweeping into office with this enormous popular majority behind him, could have anything he wanted, and he didn't do it. You know, he doesn't go out and get what his followers want. You know, why does that keep happening? Is it because they're bought off, or is it just because they have a different vision that we, the voters, don't really understand? And I think that's what it is, that they have an ideology that we have yet to grasp. Yeah. And I sort of hinted at it in my Guardian story that you were talking about. But, I'm going to be talking about this for the next year.
Well, and we'll be talking with you soon, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
But just to wrap that thought up, because there is clear evidence. In 1992, Bill Clinton got elected with a trifecta. The Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House. And 2 years later, they got nothing done, and the Republicans came back. The same thing happened when Obama got elected. He got the House, the Senate, and the White House. And 2 years later, the Republicans came back and very little got done. And, you know, it does leave you scratching your head, I must say. Now, to Obama, of course, the entire economy crashed under Bush, and he rescued Wall Street at the expense of Main Street.
That's right. I think he paid for that. I mean, and again, an act of idealism to a certain degree. But, you know, this is the tragic story of these guys, that they always represent them, and they're doing this with Hillary right now. They represent themselves as being the pragmatic wing of the Democratic Party. You know, they're the ones who can cut deals and get stuff done. And the fact is, every time they get in, when Clinton lost the House in 1994, I couldn't believe it. Democrats had held the House since the Great Depression. You know, they had an automatic majority there, and Clinton lost it, and they've never really got it back. That's the pragmatic wing of the Democratic Party. The realistic centrist wing of the Democratic Party has basically succeeded in frittering away their status as the majority party.
Well, Thomas Frank, I thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and most recently, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. His forthcoming book is Listen Liberal, and he has an article at The Guardian. The issue is not Hillary Clinton's Wall Street links, but Democrats' core dogmas. We're going to take a brief station break and back going to Nevada for an update on the Nevada caucuses, where the latest polls have Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders neck to neck. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Eric Hersick, who's a professor of political science and the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, the American presidency, and the politics of Nevada. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Hersick.
It's a pleasure to be on.
And according to the latest CNN poll, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are in dead heat for next Saturday's Democratic primary in Nevada. Is that your understanding, that that Bernie Sanders has crept up on – actually, he's raced up on Hillary. She had a pretty formidable lead, didn't she, originally?
Well, unknown how big a lead she had because there wasn't a lot of polling until recently. But the general consensus, and I shared that, is that Clinton did have a lead and this was a good state for her. And now the general consensus, and I agree with this, is that Bernie Sanders has, as you said, raced up and caught her.
And this is a significant caucus, is it not? It's dubbed as the first in the West caucus. And what kind of reaction do you think there'll be with the national punditry if there's an upset victory?
I said early on that this Nevada caucus was important to both candidates in the sense that Bernie Sanders had to prove he could win outside of, well, west of the Mississippi, and also in a state that's more ethnically and economically diverse than Iowa and New Hampshire. At the same time, it's a big one for Hillary Clinton because this is one of the first two so-called firewalls that she had. Again, a state that's more ethnically and economically diverse, and so she made a big push in Nevada. She started organizing here back in April and has a very good ground operation. So a loss for Clinton is a major blow to her going into South Carolina, which becomes her almost like her last stand, so to speak. And it's a major victory, obviously, for Sanders, who was really not counted on to make this race close.
But in terms of the diversity that's often spoken about in terms of the earlier Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary being largely white states, in the 2002 general election exit polls, 64% of voters were, this is in Nevada, 64% of voters were white and 19% were Hispanic. So is the Hispanic quotient being exaggerated?
Well, you're still talking an electorate that is 40% minority in some way, whether it be Latino, which is going to be somewhere between 15 and 20%, African American, which is going to be somewhere around 7 to 10%, and Asian. And so you have that level of diversity. You also have, I said, economic diversity. Nevada is still a state that's lagging the rest of the nation in terms of economic recovery. Our unemployment rate is right around 6%, generally slightly above 6%. We still have the highest number of homes that are underwater. We still have very high levels of bankruptcy linked to the Great Recession. And so, you know, certainly Iowa and New Hampshire did not have that economic profile either. So Nevada is a different state than what we've seen so far.
So in terms of the mechanics of the Democratic caucus on Saturday in Nevada, my understanding, according to the sort of dean of reporting there in Nevada, John Ralston, that he's pointed out that this same-day voter registration that the Democrats allow for, I believe the Republicans who have their caucus, or is it a primary or a caucus, by the way, on the Republican side?
The Republicans also have a caucus, cool, although they have some slightly different rules.
But that's on the following Tuesday, is it not?
Yeah. Yes.
And they've already closed their window on registration because in both cases, independents can't vote, right?
Right. It's a closed caucus, so you have to be in the party. The Democrats will have same-day registration, and in 2008, I want to say they got somewhere near 30,000 registrants. I mean, it was a great kind of registration effort as well as a caucus. The Republicans, for whatever reason, have decided not to do same-day registration. They even are encouraging Republicans to pre-register to make sure that their registration is valid. And that risks turning away Republicans on the evening of the caucus. I don't quite understand that in terms of party building, but it's a different approach that the Republicans are taking from the Democrats.
But what I was going to say was that John Ralston is saying that this same-day voter registration is a wild card. What do you think he means by that?
Well, you don't know who's going to show up to register. And so Hillary Clinton is really depending upon a traditional approach. She's been organized in the state, as I said, since April. She's got the backing of most of the mainstream Democratic hierarchy. She is really trying. She goes into the Latino and African American neighborhoods, and so has really kind of made this on the ground effort in the state. And so she's hoping to push her people to the polls. Sanders got organized far later in the state, about in October, and is really just relying upon what I call youthful enthusiasm, that, you know, people are feeling the burn, whatever cliche is popular these days. But his people will show up, and he's also hoping that many younger voters who may not be registered, and this is part of John's wild card comment, many younger voters will show up, register at the same time they're voting for Bernie Sanders.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Hersick, who's a professor of political science and the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, the American presidency, and the politics of Nevada. And as we said in the opening, the polls have narrowed. We're essentially now in Nevada, which was pretty much had been handed to Hillary Clinton, is now pretty much on a dead heat, with the latest CNN poll having Hillary Clinton at 48%, with Bernie Sanders at 47%. And it wasn't that long ago that she had a 20-point lead, according to Real Clear Politics. So there's something happening there, wouldn't you say, Eric?
Oh, absolutely. And it shows, in a sense, the momentum that Sanders has built up, first in Iowa by being close, and then the resounding victory that he had in New Hampshire. Moving west, you know, the question was, well, will that momentum move with him? And it clearly has. Clinton, again, better organized on the ground, but, and this is a more impressionistic comment, but when I talk to particularly Democratic voters, and like the Sanders people are just impassioned, where the Clinton people, it's almost like they're going down the checklist of, well, she's got more experience. Well, she can probably get things done. Well, she's more pragmatic. You don't get that level of enthusiasm. And right now, and I would say in the past, Democrats have often kind of gone with the candidate who enthuses them the most.
So I have read reports, Eric Hersick, that a lot of the Democratic organizers on the ground, either for Hillary and for Bernie, of course, are going after the union vote, because there's a fairly big union organization, isn't there, not in particularly around the casinos, et cetera, and the big hotels. But they're finding out with alarm that a lot of the rank and file support Donald Trump. Have you heard those reports?
I've heard something along those lines. Not so much the culinary workers. The culinary union is the biggest in the state. They have decided not to make an endorsement before the caucus. In 2008, they backed Obama, and they really helped push people to come and vote for Obama. This time, they've stayed out of it. Both Sanders and Clinton have gone after the culinary workers, in a sense, on the ground, trying to make direct contact, to the point where Sanders even snuck some people into a union hall to try to say, you know, we're union organizers. In fact, they were there for Sanders. It shows the importance, particularly of the culinary workers, which not only you're getting a two-for-one with the culinary workers, it's the largest labor organization in the state, but it's also probably the largest Latino organization in the state in terms of with a political agenda. Now, in terms of will union workers kind of just roll their eyes about both Democrats and say they like Donald Trump, this is why I think Trump may do well. He won't get those votes, obviously, in the caucus because the Republicans have it so closed. But it reflects this kind of just popularity, populist revolt, whatever you want to call it, of I know Donald Trump, or I know the name Donald Trump, and he's talking as if he's going to do it. I am skeptical that Latino union members would be backing Trump.
So with Rubio and Cruz essentially being in a dead heat for second in Nevada, what effect do you think Sheldon Adelson's endorsement of Rubio is, given that Adelson's bought the big newspaper in Las Vegas?
The Adelson endorsement is very good for Rubio. Adelson's a major player without doubt, certainly his money and now with the newspaper. He's never been a true kingmaker in Nevada. He's always kind of gone his own way, and he endorses the person who, in a sense, he feels most comfortable with that he likes. It's not a particularly ideological position. It's like, oh, I'm automatically going to vote or endorse the most conservative candidate. It's a little bit of a slap at Cruz. Cruz cannot seem to tie up any major endorsements from people outside of the most conservative part of the party. And that gets back to whether he's likable or whether he's trustworthy. And Adelson's gone with Rubio, and that is a major endorsement.
But Adelson's also made it very clear. He once said that he wished he served in the U.S. military. He'd served in the Israeli military instead of the U.S. military. And as you know, he owns newspapers, which he gives away free in Israel, that support Prime Minister Netanyahu. So he's made it pretty clear that he's a big supporter of Israel. And Rubio, of course, is his foreign policy advisors are largely the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq War. So surely that's an aspect of the endorsement, isn't it?
Oh, that's always an aspect of an Adelson endorsement. It's no secret that his major issue outside of, say, the economics of gaming is about Israel. And that's how he makes many of his choices in terms of backing, particularly national candidates. It's a kind of a two-pronged thing. He has to be comfortable with the person. So he was very comfortable, for example, in the last go-around with Newt Gingrich, and really propped up Gingrich's campaign towards the end with something like $10 million, and then just kind of sat a little bit on the sidelines just saying, well, I don't know who I'm going to endorse yet because he wasn't quite comfortable or sure of where these other candidates stood on his position. So Rubio has the right credentials to get the endorsement from Adelson.
Well, just in the last minute, Eric Herzig, what did you make of President Obama's remark yesterday at a press conference at the Sunny Lenta Retreat where he was hosting the ASEAN summit, where he said that he didn't think the American people would elect Donald Trump president? It seemed like a kind of a backhanded endorsement of the idea being that the Democrats want to run against Cruz instead of Trump. Is that how you see it?
I certainly it was a backhand at best compliment against Trump. I'm sure the Democrats would much rather run against Ted Cruz. He's the more extreme candidate. He has high unfavorables, as does Trump, but in a very different way. And he can't get endorsements, as I said, across the aisle in terms of outside of a very conservative side. I think they do fear Trump more than they fear Cruz.
Well, Herzig, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Herzig, who is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, American presidency, and the politics of Nevada. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.